No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIO and the number 1. Tonight we have a special guest with us, Bill McCall, and he is the Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for AIDS United and has been an advocate on behalf of AIDS, HIV, AIDS community, alcohol and other drug treatment and reform and criminal justice issues he's worked on for more than 20 years. He works on implementation of healthcare reform, strengthening Medicare, Medicaid, which are Medicare is becoming closer and closer to my heart as I get older, and the Ryan White Care Act, implementation of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy and Syringe Service Program and other issues. And we're happy to have him here with us tonight. And first, before we ask Bill to come on, let me just point out that give a shout out to two members of Congress who have signed on to our statehood bill in the last 10 days. One is David Loebsack, I'm sorry, Democrat from Iowa's 2nd District, and the other is Lucille Roybal Allard, a Democrat from California's 40th District. You know, California now has 20 co-sponsors of the bill, Maria.
And how many is, does any other state rival that number?
Yeah, there are a few that are close, but California leads. So,
wow.
So the people of California still believe in democracy, and we appreciate that. But yeah, there are now 141 co-sponsors in the House, 20 in the Senate, the most we've ever had. So,
and any more movement with you and your campaign in Puerto Rico's?
Puerto Rico really hasn't, you know, they've appointed a delegation, but just as they were about to come to Washington, of course, the hurricane hit. So nothing much is going on in Puerto Rico right now in terms of moving this forward, but we're still in touch with them. And, you know, I mean, God, Maria, there's still people down there without power.
I know.
And it's just amazing.
I think it's 8 weeks now too.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Let's not digress. We could talk about that the whole show, but let's get Bill on with us to talk about. And we've asked Bill to be on the show today because it's, as you may or may not know, our listeners may or may not know, December 1st was World AIDS Day. So let's welcome Bill. Bill, are you out there?
I am. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Michael.
Pleasure to be here.
And Bill. Thank you for joining us and for your service to our country and what a career you've had. Could you, I know Michael gave in the introduction a little overview, but would you mind sharing with our listeners more of your journey to where you are today? Because you've been all over the place in terms of your advocacy and your campaigning and what you do with public policy.
Yeah. And before you start, Bill, excuse me, because I forgot to do something that I always do with veterans, and that is thank you for your service. My brother was an F-111 pilot in the Air Force, so thanks so much for your service in the Air Force. Now go ahead and tell us the rest of your story.
And
thanks
brag.
So much. Yeah, actually, I think my father, who was a colonel in the Air Force, might be listening along with my mom. So,
and my dad was in the Air Force too.
Well, thank you all for your service.
Yeah, my dad served in the Korean War.
Oh wow! Oh my goodness! Yeah, it's pretty interesting to run across a bunch of folks with those connections. So thank you. So you know, I guess it is an interesting thing that I started off kind of pursuing a military career, but at the end of the day, I think what happened was I just was super interested in politics. Decided to go into law school. And did so at the University of Maryland, which, of course, was in Baltimore, and it was almost natural to come down here. I got extremely interested in drug policy and interested in syringe exchange. And so that's actually the door that I walked through to get involved with HIV and AIDS. Was first by focusing on syringe exchange, but now, of course, it's an intersectional epidemic with a number of different issues, including the opioid epidemic, but also hepatitis C and quite a lot. So that actually got me interested in the areas of public health, and that's what happened. Was I came down to Washington, started working with Congress on public health, and actually was among the advocates who helped to end the ban on the use of local funding for the district for needle exchange, and that really that was a really major success for us, actually, even at the national level.
Well, you know, Bill, since you brought that up, let me say that this is an example that we use all the time in our fight for statehood, is the fact that we had a needle exchange program that we were willing to pay for with our own money, because it was best practice. You know, we knew it was best practices to fight the AIDS epidemic here in Washington. But Congress took it out of our budget for many years, and we feel in the district that, you know, many people probably lost their lives because of that. So what did you do to make that happen? Tell us.
So actually, I was working at the organization that was the forerunner to AIDS United, which is the product of a merger called AIDS Action Council. And along with several other advocates, we literally knocked on more or less every door of Congress to try to get a vote count and convince the then Speaker Nancy Pelosi to go on ahead and hold a vote. And actually, at the end of the day, we were able to show that we had enough support from Democrats that we were able to do that. It didn't hurt that at an event that she was hosting, someone stood up publicly and said, "Okay, it's really great that you're doing all this work for folks. How about syringe exchange?" And she called over her staffer at that time and said, "So what's going on with syringe exchange?" And I think that sort of public that public event also convinced her to do that. I should also give out a shout out to somebody who has been at the time a great champion of the District of Columbia, was David Obie, and he was the top appropriator, and so he also did that. But, you know, the getting this done in the district helped to do a number of different things. The first thing is, most importantly, is it did end from 1998 to 2007, Congress had been blocking the district from using its own local funding. It ended that, and we know that since that time, beginning in 2007 through 2016, the number of drug-related HIV diagnoses went from 149 in 2007 to 7. And,
wow.
I mean, it's powerful. That's practically, you know, and we've been able to do quite a bit of the same thing with mother-to-child transmission, all of those things. I will just say that having that example of successfully being able to make that change in the district then allowed us to make a change at the federal level to allow syringe exchange first from I think it was fiscal years 2008 to 2010 to 2012. It got rolled back. But then, frankly, in the wake of an outbreak of HIV in 2015, which wow. happened to be in Indiana, where Vice President Pence, now Vice President Pence, was the governor at that time, that was related to injection drug use, all of a sudden folks said, wait a second, maybe we, maybe there is a reason this is the best practice. So,
and did it change that state's applications?
Yes. It absolutely did. It changed the way people thought about HIV. A number of states right in that area, Kentucky, Indiana, most recently North Carolina, these are relatively conservative states. They've all agreed to allow syringe exchange. And, in fact, the federal government now does allow the use of federal funding for syringe access. So
and am I
the district
right
inspired that?
And am I right, Bill, that we had reached an epidemic here in Washington before this happened? I mean, weren't we the number one site for new AIDS cases as a city in America when they passed the needle exchange thing?
I think we were number one at that time, certainly one of the top three. And actually, one of the amazing stories in the district is that beginning about that same time with really strong intervention from the health officials in the district, there's now been a 74% decline in new cases in the district from 1,333 in 2007 to 347 in 2016. And a lot of that has to do with better medications, better, you know, working harder to find cases, working hard to get people into treatment and care. There's a, you know, it's a new day in the issue of HIV. We now know that if we can find somebody and help them get to an undetectable viral load, they are uninfectious send diseases to pass the disease to somebody else. And that's the basis, frankly, along with helping people to get access to pre-exposure prophylaxis, which just means using an antiretroviral drug called Truvada for prevention. So somebody who is not HIV positive can take this drug and immediately reduce the likelihood that they would be that they would become infected to very very minimal almost reduce that by 96%. But then on top of that, we know somebody who is infected with HIV who is taking their antiretroviral drugs and gets to a an undetectable viral load, that person cannot infect somebody going forward. And that's the basis, frankly, for us talking about ending the epidemic in the United States. We think that we could do this. Frankly, we think that we could, with enough energy, actually do it worldwide.
So what's the target for that, do you think? Do you have a year, like 2020 or 2025?
The district actually has a target. They've released their own plan, which was released actually last World AIDS Day in December of 2016. It's called the 90-90-90-50 plan. And
that rolls right off the tongue.
That just is exciting, right? But it's the plan to end HIV and the HIV epidemic in the District of Columbia, and it calls for basically having 90% of HIV-positive district residents aware of their status, having 90% of those who have been diagnosed receiving treatment, and 90% who are in treatment achieving viral load suppression by 2020, And the goal would be to reduce the number of new diagnoses to 185 or fewer by 2020, which is a 50% drop from the number of new cases that were created that were there in 2015. So,
which sounds ambitious, but is it realistic?
I think it could be doable if they get very aggressive and if they're able to continue to use funding. They do a good job of doing condom distribution. They do a good job of if they can reach out to populations in which HIV is stigmatized, or men who have sex with men, for example, still the population that is experiencing the most new infections, particularly African-American men who have sex with men in the district, but also African-American women. If they can continue to reach out at that level, then I do think that that's possible for them to reach that that goal, or get close. Even, you know, right now we're at 347. If we could get to 250, you know, that's an exciting difference. You know, it's, and I think part of this is really truly about reaching out and really truly about the stigma. You know, in the district, so this is data from 2014. Black males living with HIV were diagnosed at 2.8 times that of white males. And for Hispanic Latino males, it's 1.5 times. If you're talking about black females, black women, the diagnosis is 27.5 times that of white women.
Wow.
And it's 5.8 for Hispanic and Latina. And I think that this reflects, you know, a lack of access to care, and sometimes HIV, primary care doctors not necessarily thinking about, oh, I should test this person, you know. So one of my things is, look, if you're HIV negative, if you think you're HIV negative, go on ahead and get tested anyway, you know. And if you are negative, there are things that you can do to protect yourself, including if you think you might be at risk, you know, taking PrEP, the pre-exposure prophylaxis that I mentioned.
The pre-exposure one? Wait, just my phone.
Yeah,
sorry, Michael. Do you take that as needed, or daily, or forever, or situationally? How does that work?
So the recommendation from the FDA is to take it daily. There are studies. There's a study from France. I believe it was called the Iperge study. That suggests it might be possible to take it situationally, but right now the recommendation is to take it's one pill called Truvada, and it would be taken once daily. And the manufacturer of that pill, Gilead, does have programs to make the pill more affordable. And actually, I believe that both the DC Medicaid and most insurers will cover the pill in the district.
Yeah, and that was going to be my question, Bill, is how readily available is the drug? I mean, given that I assume that AIDS is still spreading among young people as opposed to older people. I may or may not be right about that, but how do we get this drug in the hands of the people that really need it? Is it getting there?
I think that's one of the biggest questions that we've got, is how do you reach out to especially these young folks who are at greater risk but have probably less experience navigating the medical and care system. I think that there are really good organizations that are out there on the ground that can do it. I was just literally last night at an award ceremony for Us Helping Us, which is an African-American led organization for particularly for black gay men, that was a response, an early response to the epidemic, to help people provide you know, things like food or cleaning to people who were affected, and of course when they were founded, it was you know, people were dying you know, at an unbelievable rate. So we're at this really interesting space in the epidemic where it's been a lot less of that, but they can do that outreach. They go to clubs, they go to, you know, they have spaces where they just go talk to people. And so I think it's like almost at this point a person-by-person effort. Ad campaigns, it's important to have that information out there. And to some extent, the district has been doing that. To some extent, private organizations can do that. Put the information up there in the metro, put it up on the side of buses, and, you know, talking to shows like this. This is one reason that we do this, is to come out here and spread the word.
Well, let me ask you, are we doing a good job at that? You know, I mean, I know young people are risk takers, right? I used to ride a Harley Davidson with no brakes. I still ride a Harley Davidson, but now it has brakes, you know. But when I was 17, I used to drag my feet. So, you know, you think you're invulnerable, right? And that nothing can happen to you. So are we reaching young people? Are we doing that effectively, do you think?
I think this is the hardest group to reach, and I will just say right now, I don't have it for the district, but I can tell you that new HIV diagnoses in the United States, the most affected populations are the 25 to 34-year-olds, then before that, 13 to 24-year-olds, so we're really talking 13 to 34, you're in that group. And then black gay men or men who have sex with men, white gay men, and then Hispanic or Latino gay men, and then black heterosexual women. So it's youth, it's people of color, and it's particularly gay men, but also to some extent heterosexual women. And that's particularly true in the district. And I have to say, I think it's the case that, you know, we probably just continually need to improve our efforts to reach out to these groups. There are also a lot of marginalized groups. So people who are injecting drugs, obviously, we've managed to get that rate down, but that's largely because we've created services for syringe access. So I have to give out a call. A shout out to a group called HIPS, of which I'm full disclosure on the board. They work to reduce the harms associated with sex work in the district, and they do an amazing job of doing literally taking a van out and doing outreach. And they will provide people with hot cocoa on cold nights, or you know, they've got a range of things. And part of this is just about connecting people to these medical systems and spaces where there could be some help. You know, if somebody who has been, using syringes gets interested in using clean syringes and they're talking to the HIPS people, then maybe they'll also get interested in other aspects of their health. They'll get tested for HIV if they're not positive, maybe, you know, if they're HIV negative, maybe they would say, oh, it's time for me to consider going into some sort of treatment program. They can do all of those links. I'll say the other place that we absolutely have to think about is housing. Housing instability affects all of, you know, these groups so much. You know, young people don't necessarily have access to a strong housing situation, either, you know, maybe they're getting kicked out by their parents who are worried about, you know, men who have sex with men, if, you know, their kids, they don't agree. So, you know, we hear about that all the time, about getting kicked out. You know, that lack of housing leads to very unstable situations and to, you know, much more risk-taking, including, frankly, having, you know, survival sex for shelter or for food. And so that's something that that we also need to work on, is getting more opportunities for housing.
May I provide an anecdotal story that's kind of an answer to Michael's question as well? As, I have a gay friend who's 50, and he was going to start dating a younger man who was in his 20s, and they were talking about their sexual pasts, And he, my friend, found out that this young man had never used protection, and he was outraged. And he said, how dare you? How could you? Why would you? Why would you take that gamble? And he said, because by the time I get HIV AIDS, there'll be a vaccine for it. And he was like, oh, my goodness, young man, I'm going to sit you down and talk to you about the history that my generation has been through. How dare you be that cavalier about it? So not only is it that they think that they're invulnerable, but they figure that science is going to catch up and they're going to be OK down the line, just like the flu or something.
And you know what? I'm sorry to say this to you, because I know you're the mother of boys, but young men are stupid. You know, I mean, let's face it. When we think back of the things we did and the risks we took as young people, you know, I've always believed that God takes a special interest in children, or I would have never made it to adulthood. I think that there's so much misinformation out there. I've had young people tell me that you can see it in people's eyes when they have AIDS. Oh, you can tell. Well, you know, no, yeah, that's crazy. So let's talk for a moment, Bill, about World AIDS Day. Why is this important? I think it's important. It was December 1st, and I think it's important because I think we've become somewhat complacent about this, because as you stated in the statistics, the cases of AIDS have gone way down. I mean, 20 years ago, I knew people that had this disease. I had a friend that passed away, but you don't hear as much about it anymore. And that's why I think it's important. World AIDS Day is important. What's your opinion on this?
I absolutely agree. I mean, even though even though we've gotten into a situation where we are able to help people live longer and healthier lives, you know, tens of thousands of people still die in the United States every year from HIV. We know in the district that in 2014 there were specifically 113 deaths of people with diagnosed HIV that was related to HIV, and you know, that's not an insignificant number. But it's not just about the mortality; it's about the fact that the progress that we're making is. You know, not just because this just happened out of nowhere. It's because we actually did end up creating a response, you know, by expanding Medicaid, by making sure that people had access to treatment and care at the federal level, by creating the Ryan White program that provides treatment services and drugs. It provides funding to cities like the district to continue to provide these services. We have funded HIV prevention at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We have also funded housing through the Housing Opportunities for People with AIDS, HOPWA program. And all of these things are what has contributed to the overall change in addition to the major research that we funded, you know, that actually helped to create the drugs that provide both this prevention and treatment effect in the first place. You know, and I think one of the concerns is that people will say, oh, well, we've now solved this problem. You don't need any more funding, really, more than you've already got. Or, you know, and I think our message right now is this is not the time to take our foot off the pedal. You know, if anything, a little more gas would move us faster forward, you know, and we could actually reach this idea that we could reach the end of the HIV epidemic in the United States. And it's hard for probably people of our generation to even process, because, you know, it just seemed like such an intractable problem. But the other thing that's happened is we know that it's gone from being a top three healthcare issue that people think about, you know, that requiring a response to, you know, when people are now thinking about those kinds of things, sure, they think about opioids and that kind of thing, but way down there, like 20, 25, is where people are starting to think about HIV. They don't think about it as a continuing issue. So the idea of World AIDS Day, though, is really to celebrate these kinds of changes, to commemorate our losses, which, again, continue to be ongoing. Just this year, and I've forgotten his name, but a Broadway playwright, you know, who was in his 40s and not at all, you know, within the categories that we think of, literally passed away from HIV, was diagnosed with it very late, and by the time they found out, they, you know, even though he actually had access to health care, he passed away. So these are things that we absolutely have got to, you know, continue to raise. And one reason that we have World AIDS Day is specifically so that there's just one day a year when we're thinking about it. Can I just add, the other thing
yeah,
is
please.
It's also a day when we think about it in terms of the global epidemic. So it's not just that the U.S., you know, has an epidemic and we need to work on that, but rather that, you know, there is an epidemic going on throughout the world. There are more than 32 million people affected by HIV, and, you know, millions of people pass away each year. And so one thing that the United States has done is to create the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR. That's a program that provides funding directly to, I believe, currently it's 18 countries, and it has saved millions of lives. And actually, it's also a reason for us to think, you know, we can get a handle on these epidemics, because in some of the countries that we help do this type of funding and provide treatment in, they are also experiencing lower rates as they've got more people on you know, virally suppressed. So I think it's just really an opportunity to talk about all of these things.
Let me also ask you, are we doing enough to be proactive in Washington, D.C., given that you're talking about the age groups that you seem to mention are the new people that are moving into D.C., right? We have millennials moving in in droves, 1,000 new people a month into the district, many of whom are millennials, and also housing being a problem. Housing's at again in the Washington D.C. inside the District of Columbia. We're in the middle of a housing crisis too. So, are we doing things to try to mitigate this? Are we doing enough to mitigate it?
So, I guess I would say, probably the answer to that is that the district relies on a combination of its own local funding plus the funding that becomes available from the Department of Health and Human Services, plus a combination of mandatory spending such as Medicaid in particular, but also Medicare, to create, I guess, a synthesis of responses to the HIV epidemic. I do think that the district has gotten better. I don't think we would have seen the kind of decline that I mentioned earlier if the district hadn't gotten better. And actually, I know for a fact that the district has been responding for many years to the D.C. Appleseed and the Washington AIDS Partnership. D.C. Appleseed used to release a report, a report card on the district's efforts to address the HIV crisis, and I think that they really did push the district to get much more flexible with their funding and to also get more efficient. I'll also say that I do think that the health department, Michael Carfin is the director of the city's HIV AIDS response, went through a number of leadership changes. You know, it'd be nice to see more stability there, but Michael's been there a while, and I think obviously cares very much, and I do think that he's been able to be relatively effective. And I do think that the health department director, Laquandra Nesbitt, is also aware of these issues. At the same time, you know, there's not really enough to get to everybody that we need to. And, you know, the thing that I feel like is still kind of missing that I would love to see more of is, you know, continuing media focus on this, you know, with much more of a, you know, public service type campaigns and things like that. We don't do that the way we used to back in the early days of the epidemic.
Bill, you mentioned in passing the Ryan White program, and I know you're involved with that too. And I thought it would be a good opportunity to mention the brief history of who Ryan White was and what he went through and why the program is named after him.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. The Ryan White program is a program that provides funding for treatment and care for people living with HIV. It provides funding in what are called different parts. So part of the funding goes to cities directly, part goes to states, and actually for the purposes of the bill, the district is actually considered the equivalent of a state. Then it also provides direct funding to clinics and to services for families that are affected by HIV, so for services for families, youth, and children, and then finally for education and workforce training, as well as for dental. And I would say that the district receives funding from every single one of those parts in some form, either directly to the health department or to clinics within the city. Ryan White was a young man in the 80s who was a hemophiliac. He contracted HIV because of, as did just almost the entire hemophilia population, which actually at that time almost was entirely wiped out. The story of what has happened to people who were hemophiliacs is to some extent lost in a way, but something like 90% of people from that era who were infected did not survive. And only until drugs came on in 1996 did people survive. So he was in Indiana in a small school, and the school would not allow him to attend classes, despite knowing that AIDS, HIV, and the late stage of HIV, which is called AIDS, was not transmissible through casual contact. So one of the myths that is out there is, well, can you get it on a plate? No, that is not true. Can you get it from kissing? No, you cannot get it from kissing. And so those are the you know, like, basic things that we still struggle with today. Some people still have confusion over this. So the result was, basically, he was ended up having to sue the school, and was eventually allowed to return to the school. And unfortunately, the situation was so dire that he ended up having to move to first Indianapolis, and then I believe to Florida, because of the discrimination and the stigma that was played out with him. That played out numerous times in the 80s. It was a new disease. People really had very little understanding, and they didn't. People were so fearful that that they just couldn't, I think, deal appropriately with you know, somebody like Ryan, who was not in any way a threat to the others around him. So at the end of the day. Oh, I was just going to say, so at the end of the day, his cause was taken up by a number of people. It became well-known in Washington, and He died in 1990, and to honor him, the program that did eventually coalesce as the Right White program with all of the parts that I mentioned was created. And actually, it was a bipartisan. I will just say one thing that people don't seem to know is that the response to HIV has almost always been bipartisan. Senator Orrin Hatch, who is still in the Senate, and Senator Ted Kennedy, where the senators came together to create this, and then Henry Waxman, who is a Democrat, and a Republican whose name is now escaping me, were the other side. So that's also something that we work with and that we think about when dealing with HIV at the congressional level.
That there is such a thing as bipartisanship, yeah. Which is there a, is such a beautiful thing as bipartisanship. Story.
Yes, and I'll say, you know, we go to appropriators and we say every year we've got this issue. We're concerned about it. Don't, you know, please keep our funding intact. If anything, we ask for increases. And while right now we've we have not actually seen cuts over the last few years in comparison to some other programs, and I do think that that's part of that legacy.
Nice.
Yeah, we seem to have forgotten what bipartisan means in the in Washington, at least nationally. We don't need to be bipartisan locally because we only have one party in the District of Columbia. But so before we're getting a little on here in the show, we've got a few more minutes, but give us some information of how people that might be listening can connect to get information from you and from other sources. Is there a website? Is there a, you know, how do people, if they want to know more about this, if they want to know how to get diagnosed or where to go or where to get the drugs, what do they do?
And activism.
And activism, yes.
Yes. Well, I think there's kind of a lot of different ways that folks could get involved in activism. I will first mention one of our public policy committee members is Whitman Walker Clinic in the district. They are a very well-known and strong organization responding to HIV, and they are one of the original responders that helped create AIDS United, actually, at a time when there was very little federal focus. They knew that they could get to the cities, but they couldn't get federal funding, so they banded together with a number of organizations that were responding to LGBT issues or to HIV and created my own organization. So I certainly have to give a shout-out to them. And, you know, you can just call them. They're at 202-332-9255. And I think they're easily findable online. It's Whitman Walker Clinic. Another place that actually does volunteerism I've already mentioned is HIPS. If you go to hipsdc.org, you'll find there that information. And then it's also possible to look, you know, to talk with them about potential services. AIDS United can be found at www.aidsunited.org. We don't typically take volunteers, but what we can provide are basically we have a policy action center that will help people to respond, especially to federal policy. And for those of you in the district, you know how important it is to continue to be in touch with both the White House and with other members. And we certainly urge you to get your relatives outside of the district to call. So one of the things that we've tried to do, so this tax bill that just passed, which to be honest, AIDS United opposed, largely because we are concerned about the impact both on Medicaid and on the potential cuts that that it could force into discretionary funding, such as the Ryan White program. We, you know, we sent out a number of alerts that helped to connect people to get a hold of key targets and senators. We continue to do that. And then finally, if you go to dc.gov and just put HIV into the search, you'll find the district's health department. And frankly, I have felt that they are generally pretty responsive in helping people to get to services or to locate clinics or groups that are near them. I'll just add that there are similar, we're talking especially about the D.C. area, but D.C., near suburbs in both Maryland and Virginia also have very similar spaces, and so the Department of Health for those areas, and I'll just say West Virginia as well, which is part of our Ryan White area, that can be done. So
wow, that's a
actually,
lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of services, and actually I'm just going to real quickly throw out the phone number for the Department of Health. It's 202-442-5955. So that's 202-442-5955. And they can help you to figure out how to get tested. If you test positive, they can help you figure out how to get treatment and care services. And they can also help with prevention. So I recommend all of those organizations.
So what haven't we asked you, Bill, that is there anything left you want to say, anything important that we've missed that you want to add?
I would just like to say, first of all, that we've already mentioned Puerto Rico earlier, in terms of its policy related to the district, but Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands were hit by Hurricane Maria, and I think the Virgin Islands were hit by a previous hurricane. They continue to operate without electricity. They continue to have, it's a major healthcare crisis, and I'll just say we've got some folks from Puerto Rico coming in later this week, and we're going to sit down and talk with them about what can be done. But I just want to note that the plight in Puerto Rico is very high, that and the Virgin Islands, that we, definitely from Age United are concerned about being in support of them, and particularly around the issues of HIV and it's the related opioid and HCV epidemics. This is truly a crisis, and anything that people can do to generate attention to that, I think, is very important. One other quick thing. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say one other quick thing, which I guess I'm going to mention in terms of D.C. being part regionally of the South, is that the South actually is experiencing the highest rates of new HIV diagnoses in the United States as a region. And it's actually quite remarkable at, 18.5 diagnoses per 100,000 people. The very next area is the Northeast at 14.2. And, of course, those are across states. But the urban areas in the South, which are especially at risk, and the highest rates of new HIV diagnoses throughout the United States are there. So another thing that we're thinking a lot about is how do we get help and energy to helping the South to think both regionally and to begin to institute programming that would allow them to get more funding and to provide more services. I will say that in part this is a little bit about the South refusing to do things like expand Medicaid, and to some extent we absolutely have to continue to beg them to really do that and help these populations. But I'm very conscious of the district in many ways being a part of that. And while we're no longer one of the top 10 cities with the highest rate of HIV diagnoses, which is awesome, and I think talks a lot about what the district has been doing. It is part of this region and something to think about as well.
Well, thank you so much, Bill, for coming on. We very much appreciate this. We hope you'll come back as and give us an update in the future. Let me just put in a plug for the United States Air Force in case the colonels out there are listening. I know that you went into the Air Force, Bill, and they chose another path. And so did my brother. My brother, who was a F-111 pilot in the Air Force, just retired as president of a college. So the Air Force is a great place to start. Wouldn't you agree?
And
thanks so much for coming on. And we hope to have you back again soon.
It's certainly my pleasure, and I'm happy to come back anytime. Thanks to both of you. I really appreciated this conversation.
Yeah, you had a wealth of information to offer. It's definitely of value to our listeners.
Super. Well, okay. Definitely, I encourage people to go out there, get tested, go find the folks from us helping us, or HIPS. Just take that first step. It'll change your life.
Thank you so much, Bill. Appreciate that.
I've cut Bill off a couple of minutes early because I have a couple of announcements to make.
Okay.
If you're in the Washington area, on Wednesday at 1 o'clock in the John A. Wilson Building, which is at 1350 Pennsylvania Avenue, the New Columbia Statehood Commission, of which I am a member, will come to have its second annual public meeting. So if you're out there and you're listening and you're a fan of the show, please show up because we could use your support. And it'll be me, the other senator, Paul Strauss, and Representative Garcia, along with the mayor and the chairman of the city council. So please show up. And
what time did you say, Michael?
It's from 1 to 2.
Now, how likely is that people are going to be able to come in the middle of the day?
Well, that's exactly why they plan it from 1 to 2, Maria, so people won't come. And that's why we're encouraging people to come. Yeah,
it's terrible.
A very good card. It is. It's terrible that they do that. And I am an equal voting member of the commission, but was only informed at close of business on Wednesday without any consultation that the meeting – I mean on Friday, that without any consultation, yes, that the meeting would be held Wednesday. And it's one of two public meetings we have. So they wait till the last minute. They make it as inconvenient as possible. And the reason is they don't want us out there talking about the issue. So if
isn't there protocol that when meetings have to be announced and when the folks have to be informed and how and et cetera, most organizations have that in their bylaws.
Yeah, but this is the District of Columbia. We're kind of the Wild West out here, you know. My dad used to say there was an upside and a downside to everything, and the upside for politicians in Washington is that nobody pays attention to them. The D.C. City Council and the mayor kind of do whatever they want to do, and it's amazing. There are plenty of rules. There's a rule that says if you put in a FOIA request that you have to. You know, they have to respond in 15 days. It's a matter of law. I put in a FOIA request in September. It's December. They still haven't responded other than having a senior member of the mayor's staff call and try to intimidate me. But I'm not easily intimidated, thank God.
You are on the Wild East.
Yes, we are on the Wild East. And God bless the people of California who keep on supporting our issue. And let me to ask everyone that's listening to go and support the issue by going to statehoodnow.org and signing the petition for D.C. statehood. Statehoodnow.org. And you can sign your name to the petition, and that would be a great help. Anything you want to add, Maria?
Other than you and I were speaking prior to the program that I got into the holiday spirit, and for me, because I'm Catholic, into the Christmas spirit.
Yes,
because yesterday, the Cancer Support Community, where I am a volunteer and an intern, had the annual holiday homes tour. that you go into these 10,000 square foot homes and see how they prepare for the holidays. And it was a rare and raving success. I shouldn't say rare, but it was a rare experience. And from there, I went and did some holiday shopping, which I'm not a holiday shopper kind. And then today I went to the boutique that is also supporting the cancer support community. And again, and now I feel like I'm really in the season.
Good.
So it's lovely. Yeah.
Well, and you'll be in a great mood for next week's show, where we're going to have Carol Schwartz, the last living Republican in the District of Columbia.
I'm looking forward to that conversation.
But Carol has been a longstanding Republican elected official in the district, and she's just written a book, and she's been kind enough to agree to come on the show next week. Perfect. So we're really looking forward to that. We're going to leave tonight with a dedication to our guest Bill and to the lovely people of California. here's something from Sly and the Family Stone. If you don't know it, they're from San Francisco. But here's a song from them reminding us that we're all in this together. Thanks, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening.
Give the people their right to vote.